Hello, everyone. Welcome once again to the Real Life Work Podcast. I'm your podcast host, Kevin McManus. It is March 23rd in 2023. And today's topic on the Real Life Work Podcast is going to be training effectiveness, and in particular, the top 10 measures for measuring training effectiveness. So that's going to come up in the second half of the podcast, probably about 15 minutes from now. Please don't fast forward it, but if you want to, I can understand the anticipation. But let's start off with looking at the groundwork for where all this comes from so you can maybe understand a little bit of my insanity. So over the years, I've filled the role of trainer in a lot of different ways. And actually, I started training people way back when I was a Boy Scout at regional Boy Scout camp, you know, teaching people pioneering skills and wilderness survival skills and nature skills and weather skills and all this fun type of thing. But the first workplace training I found myself presenting was to Quality Circles, problem solving skills training. And at that point, I hadn't learned much about facilitation, but I'd had a chance to see other people that are good facilitators model the training before they expected me to teach it. And they didn't give me a lot of training hours way back there in that particular point in time. But as time progressed, I got more engaged with training. And when I went to make candy bars at the start of the 1990s, one of my main goals put forward to me by my boss was to set up a good training system. However, we weren't going to get a lot of time away from the floor to do training. We may get some, but we weren't going to get a lot of time for classroom training. So that's where I first began to look at what does it take to teach your frontline leaders how to view every day as an opportunity to train. So that's one thing that's going on. Now, at the same time that's going on in my for-pay work world, in my volunteer work world, I'm repeating the Baldrige training process for examiners. And by the time this training pattern started to make sense, producing candy bars with my seven supervisors, it was also starting to show me that, hey, it makes a lot of sense when you keep your lecture down to 10 to 15 minutes per hour, you know, about 25%, 30% of the training time. Use the rest of the time for skill practice, for dialogue, because you're going to have higher levels of learning in that type of environment. Now, we always want to remember right off the bat, people send and receive information differently. Some prefer verbal, some prefer visual, some prefer hands-on. And it's not in our best interest to try to cater to one or the other. We should try to design our training so it caters to all three learning styles. So I'm seeing what's happening in that Baldrige world. I'm seeing what I'm learning from experience, versus what I'm learning from study. I'm working with my own supervisors and my own folks, trying to teach them things, and with some degree of success, but not as much success as I would have liked. One is we couldn't get enough time away from the floor. Another thing that we found out as time went on is that we needed to improve our business literacy and our math literacy in the organization to help get us to where we needed to be. You know, we assumed that everyone could read at a 10th grade level, and that's rarely the case in an organization, especially a manufacturing facility. It's probably a little lower than that. Yeah, math skills also atrophy a bit from between the time a person gets out of high school or gets out of any kind of formal education and goes into the workplace. How many of you would like to do some algebra right now? All right. But anyway, that's kind of the time thing. And I like to start with the time thing because that's our primary constraint in organizations. And even training falls into that improvement time category. So if something has to go because the value stream requires it, training could be one of those things, along with research and development time, personal development time, growth time, engagement time, all types of things that involve time away from the value stream or away from the processes that support the value stream. And right now in most organizations, they don't have much of that improvement time. They could sure use it, but they don't have it. So what do? We have to go back and look at what do we expect from our leaders each day? What is the leader standard work that we expect? What level of training, coaching, transfer of knowledge do we expect from those folks while they're on the floor that day? And you might think, well, we send people off to the computers to learn their training. Please realize this, the computer-based training is good for compliance. You know, it can show that, yes, we watched the video, we clicked the buttons, we clicked the right buttons maybe even, and we took the course. But did we remember the knowledge in a way that's going to help us on the job? I see this repeatedly with health, safety, and environment training, where people learn the buzzwords, but then when they get on the job, they can't relate what they learned in the training relative to placarding hazardous materials to actually placarding hazardous materials to different configurations in the workplace. So please try to make your training work related. All right. Even read and sign procedures. I get it. I know what it's for, but don't expect that to be a primary transfer of knowledge tool. You know, that's a review of training document, a key training document, and make sure it's right so that the other people we train, we don't train them the wrong way. So it's a value-added effort. And it's something we should do annually to keep our procedures fresh. But it should not be seen as a transfer of knowledge tool. So that's what we actually want to look at, is when we spend time at work, when are we trying to teach people things? When are we trying to transfer knowledge? But recognize the lecture has limited results. Computer-based training has limited results. Training way ahead of time, like during onboarding. We're assuming a lot when we think that people are going to remember everything we cover during that first week of onboarding and apply it on the job. But to begin with, unless plant tour, shadowing, something like that is part of the week of onboarding where you're going back and forth between the workplace and the training area. You know, that approach can work, but if we just bring them into training rooms for 3 days, 4 days, and then turn them loose in the construction site or in the field or in the plant or in the office, it's going to be very different because the work environment's different. The people they're around are different. The relationships are different. And most of all, the processes are live. And most likely to some degree different than what we covered in the training. For more detailed, for sure. So when we think about training, and this is what I've always told myself because I recognize, you know, I had the light bulbs come on. I taught over 100 people the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, and I love teaching Covey's work. It's a foundational set of practices for good leadership that I like to follow. But the way Covey set them up is they are set up to be progressive, much like the measures that I'm going to talk about here in just a little bit. You know, you can't just jump to habit 5 and be successful across the board. You've got to progress your way to habit 5 by working your way through the 4 habits before it. Okay? So you would think knowing what the habits are is important. You would think if the trainer's good, they're going to teach you that importance of the succession and maybe put you through exercises so you learn the succession. But I did not. I covered the material as people typically covered. It was 12 one-hour classes with exercises in between the classes each week. Got everybody together about 6 months after. Did some follow-up, and one of the first questions was, well, how many people, who can name the 7 habits for me? In order. You know, when you're getting deer in the headlights from people that you thought you had transferred the knowledge to. Or when I was working with the people that had 4th or 5th grade math skills, and I was trying to teach them statistical process control that involved algebra. It doesn't jive. So that effective training is not just covering the training. It's not just participation percentages. It's not just completion percentages. And those are the first two measures. We're looking at awareness, understanding, retention, and application. And I have learned that Donald Kirkpatrick's 4 levels of training evaluation model is one of the best ones that's out there. And so that's what I'm going to work with as I proceed on through this particular podcast. Okay, so now we're looking at ways we can improve our training. Well, the first thing is if you want to get it into memory, it takes repetition. Now, ideally, psychologically, repetition and strong emotion. And so if you can get a strong positive emotion going at the same time as you're doing the repetition, it'll embed itself even better in your neocortex. But effective training requires skill repetition and practice, and that's practice with a coach. You know, think about all those times you might have practiced hitting a golf shot incorrectly or painting a painting incorrectly before the coach came along and told you the importance of understanding, you know, going from one type of color to a different type of color. And so recognize that there's a big difference between just knowing terms and maybe even understanding the terms, but being able to remember them and apply them. And so that's the aura of effective training. Awareness, understanding, retention, and application. So let's look at those 10 measures that can help us measure training effectiveness, all right? And I mentioned the first two already. But I'm going to tell you right off the bat, this is something that I struggle with. I struggle with it when I think about it, because I know from being a National Baldrige judge and examiner that even the best organizations struggle with measuring training effectiveness. Now, they measure it. They can show you multi-year trends. They can show you improvement over time. They can show you improvement towards best-in-class benchmarks. But they're often with weaker than desired indicators. Now, they don't affect the score that much, and so you can only include so much in an application, and I have not been on site visits to all these folks, so they probably have much more on site than I've ever seen myself. I've been on a fair number of site visits, and so yes, I've seen more higher level metrics, but not since Power BI came out, or not since Tableau came out, or not since new approaches for capturing who goes to training, when they go to training, testing training effectiveness, all the things we can do with tech now that we couldn't even do 5 years ago. All right. Most organizations don't measure training effectiveness at all, and some struggle to even prove they have given a high percentage of their people any formal training. Now, formal training does not have to be a classroom. It's a learning environment. And the key is you can demonstrate how the time you spend in the learning environment translates into improved performance on the job, and especially from a results perspective, okay? So as we go through Kirkpatrick's four levels, you know, we're gonna start with reaction and move to results. All right, so we're going to go through the four steps, where the first one is, hey, this is just an indicator of reaction effectiveness versus this is an indicator of results effectiveness. So, and you might say, well, hey, I measure training cost. I measure training hours. I measure completion rates. I can tell you how many people complete the courses we planned on them completing. We create a training plan, we complete our training plan. But how do those metrics show? Those are all investment metrics. How do they show that translated into work system effectiveness? So keep that in mind, that even though the first measures you're going to hear are familiar, they're also the weakest gauges of training effectiveness. So measure number one, total training cost and time. Most organizations, if they do formal training, they have to budget that training time as an expense. It'll show up on the profit and loss statement. In turn, most organizations can show you how much time and money they invest annually in training. It may just be a line item, a cost center. They may struggle to break it down into cost per class, or class cost versus development cost versus evaluation cost versus trainer development cost, and so on. But they can say, here's how much I spend a year. Here's how much is spent on compensation for individuals who attend the training. This is the work release time equivalent. And here is the cost of the training materials. And here's how many people we sent. So I can give you cost per person. But notice, that's great. I can judge a lot in terms of what your desire to train is from those numbers, but I can't tell if your training works. And then they go measure two. Hey, how about participation rates? Participation rates look at how many people attend the training versus who's supposed to be there. I mean, doesn't that mean if you're supposed to be there and you show up, it must be good training? I mean, it's probably entertaining training. But for this metric to work, first of all, we've got to have a list of courses for each job position, And then we build that into a competency matrix data set. So we know the course requirements for each job role. But just showing up doesn't mean you're going to be remembering what you showed up for or using what you showed up for on the job correctly to get good results. So foundational metrics, but much more indicative of investments up front than effectiveness on the back end. And the third one that falls into that category are your completion rates. They're a step above participation rates in that they show these people finish the course. And yes, there are cases out there where many more people attempt certain courses than complete them. Often it's a sign of a challenging course where the percentage of people who sign up versus the percentage of people that complete the course is very different. Remember some of the vintage movies that talk about that type of thing. In fact, grading on the curve. We want to flush out a certain percentage of folks, but that's not how we want to design training for work. Also, good course designs require coursework outside the classroom. And that makes completion rates a better indicator because such courses are not complete until the work outside the classroom is done. Okay, so we're getting a little better in our effectiveness indicators because at least a completion rate that is for a course that includes applied skills in a work setting, hey, we're starting to at least get it to the workplace. And as I'm laying out these lists of measures, I know that the bottom four or five are kind of my lower ones, and then my last five are my higher ones. And I struggled about smile sheets. Are they number three or are they number four? And so I'll let you decide. But smile sheets, those are your end of course, end of day evaluations. Donald Kirkpatrick refers to this as a reaction metric. This is a level one training effectiveness evaluator. Better than nothing, but it's not good enough. Plus, what does it tell you? It means people enjoyed the training. It depends on the design of the tool. What statements do you put on there? What scales do you put on there? Do you put a chance for open-ended questions to be added? And so they're still reaction indicators. They don't show what people are going to retain 1, 2, 3 months out or more. They don't show if what people retain and apply is the correct thing to retain and apply. Now, another thing the good organizations do is, first of all, they're doing an annual culture survey. Used to call these attitude surveys, call them what you want to call them, engagement surveys, whichever. I call them work system effectiveness surveys, but nobody knows what that means. But at a minimum, when you survey folks annually or when you do pop-up surveys on your intranet, put statements out there with a training focus. So for example, I received the training I need to do my job effectively. The training I attend is effective, and score them on a strongly disagree, sometimes agree, disagree, agree, and then strongly agree scale. And I can give you more if you're interested, but those are two of the more common ones that folks use. Again, they're reactionary, but because the survey's annual, there's a timing thing going on. And so sometimes that delay between when they took the course and when they complete the survey, if you still rate the training high, that means something. I don't know what it means. I'd have to build theories with my coworkers and subject matter experts and training participants. But it means something. But that's why I put it at number four instead of number three. Okay, now let's get to end of course tests. And you can have end of course tests that are quite robust. However, I'll give you an example. When I worked at a very good regional LTL carrier, less than a truckload carrier out here in the Pacific Northwest, still one of the best organizations out here and one of the best I've ever worked for. They would not just take a commercial driver's license as proof that you can drive, put you in a truck and let you drive. There's going to be another 160 hours of testing of a variety of nature before you ever take a piece of equipment out on the road, and even then you'll probably have a driver instructor with you for a week or two. And so just passing the test doesn't mean you get it all. Doesn't mean you retained it all. Doesn't mean you can apply it all. But I hope it means you got the essence. And so what the good organizations do is they'll typically have, here's the things you should commit to memory. You have to get 100% on this section of the test. And then on the other part of the test, you can allow some, you know, some loss, some wiggle room, some errors, maybe more 75%, 80% is typical there. But the effectiveness of this measure largely depends on test design. So for example, if you require a hands-on skill demonstration test, that's a much more effective indicator of skill acquisition than a simple true-false test. It sounds like common sense, but look at how you assess competency. You know, what I use as my benchmark is how I was trained as a scout and how I was trained as an examiner. Those are my two best training experiences in life. And I look at the wide variety, over 100 different skills, different types of skills I learned as a scout, but the structure of the certification process was always the same. There were things you had to commit to memory. There were things you had to be able to discuss in more long form. There were things you had to demonstrate over time. There were things you often had to do long enough to make it a habit before you could have passed and get the award. But it's that hands-on practice, that repetition, that helps people remember the most. So the remaining indicators look much more at application on the job and at results. And I start, and number six and number seven go together. Okay, they're the same tool. Number six is where they're given soon after the training, and number seven is where the tool is used 90 days after the training. Now, this tool is called a position observation checklist. I learned about it from a National Baldrige recipient. They're called PALS Sudden Service. They're the first restaurant to ever receive the Baldrige Award. They received it back in 2001. They're based out of Kingsport, Tennessee, but they're in that Tri-Cities area there, Johnson City, Bristol, Kingsport. NASCAR folks, you probably know of PALS. I can't imagine you'd go out there to that part of the land to see the cars and not also enjoy the great food of PALS Sudden Service. And I do not get an affiliate link for that. I just think they're a good organization based on what I've learned about them over the years. More importantly, I've taken this position observation checklist, created versions of my own and used them. And on my Great Systems website, I'm going to make available, I think, three different versions of these that I know I can readily access. And I even have one for like an incident investigator. You know, if you're a safety person and or an environmental person and you investigate incidents, you investigate big problems. This is, I have a tool, position observation checklist. And the way you use this tool is you observe the person as they do their work across 5 to 7 competency areas. And within each of those competency areas, you're looking to see if they do 4 to 6 key things. Now, that's part of the tool. You know, it's a well-designed tool, but how it's used is probably more important because the person assesses themselves at a given point in time, and then their supervisor assesses them after observing them in the workplace at the same point in time. Then they compare their results, and they look for gaps. They look for points of similarity. So it's an opportunity for recognition in those areas where the person's done well. We want to reinforce the good things they're doing. And it's an opportunity to coach and provide feedback in those areas where the gaps exist. And remember, there's going to be two types of gaps. There's going to be the gap where the staff member perceives they know a skill better than their supervisor perceives them demonstrate. And there's going to be a case where the supervisor thinks the person knows the skill better than the person themselves. And you will get both personalities as you use this tool. And the way it was used at PALS, it was part of a certification process. And so you were expected to maintain a 75% score or higher on your POC. And that went along with always being able to pass the 100% question test. Now, there's other regular training completion things and indicators like that. But this is kind of the core. Now, this is a behavior training effectiveness indicator if you go back to Kirkpatrick's stuff. And this behavior measure is more effective especially the 90-day one, because it shows longer skill retention and effective application. Most folks use both assessments, the one soon after the training, then the one 90 days down the road, and you can even make it a standard tool as part of your personal development process. I don't like performance appraisals. I don't like holding back the bad and giving it as a present once a year. You know, the bad needs to be addressed immediately. We can't tolerate poor performance. But at the same time, we need to recognize good performance when it occurs, not once a year. Okay, so these are good tools to help drive that, and just doing self-checks are great ways to reinforce how people are doing. Eventually, you teach the more senior team members to assess the more junior members and provide the feedback coaching. You can use that to develop your lead people and then to even develop your senior team members as we enrich jobs and expand jobs over time. Okay, so at this point in training, work system design, and measurement maturity, it's likely that we've got a certificate process that helps integrate different skill sets, different needs, and different training results. So we're moving towards an index. In both the end of course and the 90-day assessments of a skill demonstration nature, those are common with such certifications. Now, number 8 is probably my favorite as an operations person, but this is where we actually start looking for correlations, both number 8 and number 9. With number 8, we're looking for a reduction in process errors and waste. And so that's going to reflect correlation between the effectiveness of the training as scored by the trainee, maybe as scored by the trainer, and then the resultant work process down the road. In a proactive process improvement system, each process owner captures key errors and failures daily at the process level. And I don't mean every single thing, but 5 to 10 key things every 8 hours, one an hour, unless you have perfect hours. But if we track these and trend these over time and align the content of our training and the way we deliver training with our high error areas, we can begin to connect shifts in daily process results with the staff who support that process. And so we would start with a simple ratio that looks at average POC scores, average position observation checklist scores, versus the daily error and failure rates. And you want enough sensitive measures. You don't want a whole bunch of zeros in there. So, you know, look for something that's giving you at least one or two a day. Because you can have a zero once in a while, but you should be, you know, it should be sensitive enough metric-wise to where you're picking up something on a cyclical nature with the process. And maybe you have tons of perfect cycles. Great. But, you know, be challenging. Be fair. Be fair using the customer's lens. For the best results, track errors at the process nonconformance level. So you should have standard operating procedures. That's what we train from. And so when we do not follow the task or a step in the task, that's a nonconformance. Technically, it's technically an error. We won't catch them all. Not all errors cause damage. Not all errors need to be caught. But those that, you know, lead to delays or stress or messes, we need to take a look at those. And when I say your 5 to 10 errors for the areas you're responsible for each day, you know what I mean. You could write those down. You could journal those each day. Now, process-specific scrap, rework, downtime rates, you can use those, but the more aggregate you get in lumping numbers together, the harder it is to separate the effect of individual training on the individual process performance. Just remember that. The more we mix stuff together, the more it induces variation. Also, avoid the use of lagging measures, such as the site safety recordable rate. You know, look upstream at near misses. Ideally, as I said, look towards nonconformances. For equipment failures, look at downtime duration and frequency relationships. Don't just look at downtime percentage. Again, that could be an aggregate for a set of machines. But instead, look at each equipped asset's performance, mean time between failure rate, when it does go down, how often is it down? What's the, you know, what's the mean? What's the sigma? How's it distributed? Also, are there nonconformances that result in such process downtime? Can we track those? Finally, avoid the use of downtime percentages in favor of downtime minutes and frequency. So focus on the transaction level type problems. Number nine, you're going to go over to the soft skills. You're going to look at how does our training impact our engagement scores? How do better engagement scores lead to better retention rates? So if you flip it and say, what causes people to leave? What are the headaches on the job people want to get away from? And so you may find an additional level of results correlation when you look at effective training scores and improvements in engagement rates for key engagement factors. Better engagement reduces turnover, increases staff retention. That also impacts daily errors. Plus, the reduction of daily errors creates a more positive attitude towards work in general. And if we actually put in good system changes to take away those errors and failures, it might make people think their leaders care about them. And so it may sound funny, but operational excellence is something everyone needs to get out of a mess. It doesn't mean you have to become operationally excellent. It just means it's an ideal you move towards. What it means is we try to do our jobs right each day. We keep track of the big things that keep us from doing our jobs right each day. We track and trend those over time. We look at how it affects our attitudes, how we work with each other, how it affects our desire to stay with the organization and to continue to support our customers. And organizations are building data sets that allow us to look for these correlations. You know, not all the organizations that are trucking along at 40% engagement are happy there. All you have to do is pick up a Baldrige recipient application summary off the NIST site and you'll see 80-85 is much more where you should be. You know, if you're under 70, that's not cool. You know, there's people that live around 35. It's like these people that have webs. You go to PageSpeed Insights and you run their web page speed and it's down in the 15 or 20 and it's red. And it's like, well, you obviously care about your customer. No, dumping the ads is more important. No, look for the correlations. Here's the, you know, we know what we invest in the training typically. But what did we get back in terms of improved performance? And what was the people connection in the middle in terms of how did they feel about what they were taught? Did they feel like they got it? Did they feel like they still had it 3 months down the road? And when you hear me talk about this, especially all this data, don't think old school, because it was a pain to capture some of this stuff back in the day. But now there's easy ways to do lean data capture. You know, you can have QR codes on the training security badge, and you should have QR codes on your post-course test. You can have it on your training documents. You can use, that's just one example, but you can scan those and send them to an Excel database very easily now. And so it's much more easy to capture who attends the training, when did they attend the training. You can push tests to people. You can have them watch videos. You can have them follow links from the videos to tests. The whole LMS thing is so much easier to set up than it used to be. So if you have questions, just let me know. Finally, number 10, to pull it all together, a training work system effectiveness index. The ultimate gauge of training system effectiveness is an index that constitutes multiple effectiveness measures. Also, we want to make sure we give credit for those foundational course completion efforts. Yes, we did have a good participation percentage. We did have a good completion percentage. We did score well on our end of course surveys. We're scoring well on our end of course tests. Notice how each of the metrics presented in this podcast can be used in the index. They each tell a different part of the story. However, some of them tell a more important part of the story when it comes to actual impact on the job. So think about your data set construction. What training data do you need to capture for each course someone attends? What needs to be on the training form? What type of training profile should you build for each staff member? How will you set up a similar course effectiveness profile for each course? And how do you want to progressively improve your approach to training effectiveness measurement over time? You may be able to tell that effective training is a passion of mine. It was interesting. I taught around 400 Taproot courses face-to-face, over 10,000 folks if I do the math. And then I've taught around 40 virtual courses, and my goal has always been to make the virtual courses as good as the on-sites. And when I look at the work that people leave on the computer at the end of day three, I'm pleased with what I see, but I approach the course very differently. And so when we move into a virtual environment, both in terms of providing the training and coaching the individuals in the training, we have to remember that the asynchronous part of the training experience is just as important as the synchronous part. The synchronous part is the part in the classroom. That's the small part to me. When you go to the breakout rooms, you're at least going to middle ground because now we're getting hands-on. But it's that practice after the course or the practice on that final exercise where you put it all together and you demonstrate that you know how to do these different things you picked up over the 3 days. That's where we at least get a microcosm of what effective training in real life should be. And what it tells me is that in a near term, we at least made it through Aura once. You know, they're aware of how to build a snap chart, how to do root cause analysis, how to write corrective actions. They understand why it's important for all those things to knit together. The question is, what will they retain when they leave the class, especially as time progresses? One look at Ebbinghaus's forgetting curve makes you realize within a month or so, if not less, it's gone, and it could be over the weekend and it's gone. So repetition and emotions, what sinks it in? I love talking about training, teaching, training. I'd love to have the chance to share more information with you and work with you further. So please don't hesitate to contact me if you're interested. My ultimate goal when I train is sustained and effective skill application on the job. Please think about your own goals as a trainer. And if you want more information on effective training measurement, please email me. There are two pages on the Great Systems website. There'll be three. There'll be a summary page for the podcast with links to the Aura of Effective Training page and the 10 Effective Training Measures page. I thank everybody for sticking around. If you have any ideas for what you'd like me to comment on or expound on or do a bunch of research so I can talk about it intelligently on, please send them to me at kevin@greatsystems.com or find me at Kevin McManus on LinkedIn. That's where you can find my freshest content as soon as it's released. Everyone have a super remainder of March. We're into spring now. We've sprung into spring. We're getting into the 6 months of light. Everyone have a great spring, a great summer, and a great remainder of 2023. This is Kevin. Keep improving.